Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. My guest for this episode is Connor Stedman, who returns to finish our two-part series on carbon farming, this time with a discussion on how to catch and store carbon in the soil. If you haven't listened to the first episode in this series, I recommend that you start there. If you're using iTunes or an RSS reader, you'll want to go back to August 31st, 2012 to find that show. Or if you're going to listen from the website, go to thepermaculturepodcast.com and search for carbon farming with a search box in the upper right-hand corner of the main page. While you're there, you can also click the support tab and find out ways that you can support the show. It'll really help. In this episode, Connor shares with us four different methods on how to store carbon. And they are to mulch and compost, using plants, using animals, and also biochar. But we begin this conversation with soils as a whole. And we get some nice meaty conversation on what soil is and where it is that we're trying to add organic matter in order to capture carbon. Though I don't want this to sound like it's a big, weighty conversation. It isn't. We had a nice time going back and forth with this, and my geek heart smiled because Connor makes a reference to Star Wars and the Death Star as part of his explanation during the show. Catch me after the interview for some additional notes. Until then, enjoy this time with Connor Stedman as much as I did. Well, Connor, thank you for joining me again as a follow-up to our first discussion on carbon farming, where we were discussing carbon sequestration with perennial plants and trees. This time around, for part two, we're going to be talking about soils. But before we get into how we can capture carbon in the soil, could you give us an overview of what soil is and how it develops?
Sure, and thanks a lot for having me back on the show here, Scott. People have said that we know less about what's going on in soil than we know about what's going on in outer space. And I think that really speaks to how complex the soil is as this non-living and living kind of matrix that covers most of the earth in a big diversity of different forms and ways, and also happens to be the source of life for everyone through growing plants directly that we eat or growing the plants that the animals we eat. But just to simplify all that complexity a little bit, and there's people whose whole career is the detailed technical stuff of soil science, but just to give a simple picture of this, in a way, you could think about soil as a marriage between rock and life. So rock, or what we call parent material, might be bedrock. It might be, in some cases, there's no bedrock. It's just like a deep deposit of sand that might have been dropped by water in the ancient past. It might be the glacial till that was ground up by glaciers in the glaciated parts of continents here in North America. But that rock or glacial till or deep deposit of sand weathers over time through water and through the chemistry of water breaking down those minerals into smaller pieces. So that's how soil gets to have finer and finer particles. And then more minerals are then added on top through the movement of air and water. Like a dust storm can deposit a bunch of sand and silt in a place that didn't have it before, or a flood like we had throughout the Northeast here last year in the spring with the snowmelt and in the fall with Tropical Storm Irene. Those floods can deposit a large amount of mineral sediment also. And a lot of the time when people think about soil, that's what they're thinking about, is the physical non-living mineral stuff that soil is made of. But as I said, soil is a marriage between non-living and living, and the living component of soil is in some ways the part that we know less about than about outer space, because it's so complex. There's all five kingdoms of life are represented in soil biology. But two important components of that are what we talk about as the soil food web, which is the ecosystem of plants and animals and fungi and bacteria that are interacting in complex ways in the soil. And then there's the decomposition of dead bodies of plants and animals and fungi and bacteria. And that decomposition process is done by those living things, but that's in many ways really what builds the fertile soil that everyone wants in their garden and on their farm and that we are trying to build. So it's helpful to understand that process of how that material gets built. So when an animal dies in the forest or a limb falls and starts to break down, all of the physical stuff of that animal or plant's body is converted into different stuff by decomposer organisms, by insects and worms and bacteria and scavengers and all kinds of things. And the nutrients from that animal or that plant or that fungi enter into the topsoil, the top layer of decomposing organic matter. And sometimes people talk about things being dead or very dead in the soil. So a dead thing might be a tree that's died and fallen over. But a very dead thing would be that tree that's fully decomposed. And when living material fully decomposes in the top layer of soil, it forms, among other things, it forms these crazy complex molecules called humus. And humus molecules are like imagine the Death Star from Star Wars. They're like a huge sphere. They're a huge globe. They're like a little planet in the molecular matrix of the soil. And that huge planet has tons of docking ports for mineral nutrients to attach onto. So the humus molecules are actually like a naturally occurring plastic. They form that kind of greasy or gummy consistency that really rich soil has. And those humus molecules store nutrient and water. So when you have that beautiful, dark, friable garden soil, it's because of the amount of humus in that soil to a large extent. But those humus molecules are primarily made of carbon. So when we talk about storing carbon in soil, and just as a reminder to our previous carbon farming conversation, that if we don't want to do big scale geoengineering to take carbon out of the atmosphere, we can put carbon in trees where there weren't previously trees, or we can put carbon in the soil and add carbon to soil so there's more than there was before. Building up humus in the topsoil is one of the big places for carbon storage in soils, because those humus molecules, if they're not disturbed, stable over a long period of time. That's kind of the really basic chemistry of what we're going for in storing carbon in the soil.
So through this process, you want to build up the organic matter in the soil so that as it turns from dead to very dead, it becomes humus, which is then able to trap more carbon?
Yeah, so the humus itself is carbon. It's like a huge globe of carbon. And because of the way the molecule is shaped and the way they interact with each other, it gives soil that sponge-like consistency that allows it to store water, and the humus molecules hold on to mineral nutrients for long periods of time so that there's more nutrients available to plants. Plant roots, and not the big roots that we see when we dig up the plants, but the very, very fine root hairs that plants grow out at the very edges of their roots. Those root hairs actually have trading interactions with humus molecules. So those root hairs will trade a less valuable to them mineral for a more valuable to them mineral with the humus molecule so that the electrical charges stay the same. And so plants have this ion exchange all the time with those humus molecules. So that organic matter level in the soil is really critical for growing a healthy garden, growing great crops, growing great fruit, because it's like a matrix for plants to get the resources that they need to grow.
How would someone build their soil to move it in this direction?
Yeah, well, that's the real question. And there's a whole literature out there of books about how to grow great gardens and how to grow great soil and effortless soil, you know, 2 hours a week, that kind of stuff. And sometimes it can be really challenging. So before we get into those techniques, I do want to mention that the living topsoil, what we call the A horizon, the O horizon at the very top being the stuff that's dead but not yet very dead, it's still decomposing. And then the A horizon is that topsoil layer. So that's really important, but the minerals below the A horizon are also really important because they form the substrate in which that living soil gets to occur. So if you're working with soils whose mineral base is, for one reason or another, very extreme, like if you have an extremely sandy soil, I live in the Northeast, and throughout the Northeast, there's places where as the glaciers were melting, large deposits of sand were left behind by rivers emptying into temporary lakes that were formed, or like little deltas. And those sand deposits now occur in the landscape as old buried sand dunes or flat sand plains. And those deposits might be 20 or 40 or even more feet of pure sand in some cases that you'd find if you dug down. And so that sand, because its particles are so large, water just flows through it like a sieve. And as water flows through it like a sieve, it carries all those mineral nutrients away with it. And because of the chemistry of sand, the soil is very acidic, and it's very hard for it to retain fertility, and it's very dry. So if you have one of these very dry or infertile or poor soils, you can build topsoil in the manner that we're going to talk about, but there'll be some limits on what you'll be able to grow there in the long term. And you might want to consider crops or systems that are mimicking what might naturally grow on really poor soils. So there are some limits created by the mineral component as well.
You can't just build topsoil on top of any substrate and just say, I'll have a perfect garden, because it will change the environment that you're growing in.
Yeah, you can do that. And for some crops, for some very shallow-rooted crops that are only going to grow in that topsoil anyway, that's fine. But for deeper-rooted perennials whose roots are going to really get down into the B horizon below the A horizon and are going to depend on accessing water resources throughout the year and need to access minerals longer term because they're longer lived, for those perennial systems, the mineral matrix that the soil is growing on will exert an influence no matter how much topsoil you build. And that's okay. That's just the diversity of landscapes. That's why, for example, people have cherished and valued the rich soils that occur in floodplains, because those layers of silt deposited over so many centuries by floods are very chemically rich with nutrients, and they're an ideal environment for most plants to grow in a way that those dry sands aren't. So we can do topsoil building in either of those places, in a rich floodplain or in a dry sand delta, but we're going to still be able to grow better crops, or we're going to be able to grow a bigger diversity of crops and have more soil fertility and water holding capacity in the long run if our mineral base we're starting with is more suited for those things.
For someone who has access to them, and I know here in Pennsylvania, I can go to my local land-grant university and get information about this, would it be useful for someone to look at a soil map for their area to get an idea of what their underlying conditions might be?
Yes, it's extremely useful. And the soil nomenclature and language can be confusing for people who aren't familiar with it. So it can be helpful to have some coaching from someone who's familiar with that terminology. But what you can do is, in the middle of the 20th century, the United States Geological Survey mapped soil types across the whole country. And you can, state by state, and usually it's county by county, you can get digital or paper copies of those maps. So those soil survey maps, they won't tell you everything about the soil on the land where you are, but they'll give you some really good basic information, and you can look up what particular soil series it's called. That's kind of analogous to the species of an animal. Like, it's almost like the species of soil that exists there. You can look up what that soil series means, and it'll say things like, extremely rocky loam, 15 to 25% slopes. And so that'll give you some basic information. But regardless of where you are, and knowing that you know, lots of complexity and diversity in the landscape, there's techniques that we can use to build soil. And just to give you a sense of why that's both a win from the point of view of farming, but it's or gardening, but it's also a win from the point of view of climate, a 1% increase in organic matter, in soil organic matter, on 1 acre of land will sequester multiple tons of carbon out of the atmosphere. And we can often do much more than just a 1% increase. And on larger scale places, we can do that on a scale of large, just 1 acre. And since a lot of farmland and rangeland around the world is very degraded from use in the last couple hundred years, especially, there's a lot of potential for rebuilding soil organic matter. It can play a big role in this carbon sequestration puzzle.
When you mentioned increasing the soil organic matter by 1%, where does that organic matter have to go to make that happen? Would that be in the O horizon, the A, or deeper down?
It's in the A horizon, essentially. The O horizon is all organic matter. That's the still decomposing organic matter. The A horizon is where the organic matter is. Now, it's worth saying that in some kinds of soil, like very deep prairie soils, for example, A horizon might be many feet deep. And it might not be easy to distinguish there from other horizons below it. It might be a gradient that goes down instead of easy to see layers. But that's where the organic matter is stored.
And this is the area that's rich with the biological processes of the micro and macro fauna in the soil and your bacteria and all that.
Exactly. Let's look at some of those techniques here. So I'm going to talk first about some techniques that are probably familiar to gardeners in the audience. They're really standard organic gardening techniques that people have been using for a long time. And sometimes it's helpful to look at those things in a new way. So the first one I want to talk about is compost. Because compost, and I'm going to talk about compost and mulch kind of in the same sentence here, because they're really doing the same thing in a way. So in a forest, the process by which topsoil gets built, meaning that the A horizon gets deeper over time because more organic matter is being added to it, that process can be very slow. It's the accumulation of leaf litter and wood and dead animals and fungi, and it's the accumulation of dead life in that very top layer. And it can take decades or centuries to appreciably deepen that A horizon, which is one reason why it can take a very long time for forest ecosystems to recover from having been clear cut and then grazed, overgrazed, because that soil process is a very slow process. But what we're doing when we're composting food wastes or garden wastes, and we're managing that compost pile so that the microbial activity is breaking those things down faster, is we are greatly speeding up that process of soil building. It's almost like we're collecting and compressing time in the compost pile. We're taking what might take 20 or 30 years to happen in a forest, and we're doing it in 2 or 3 months. So as simple as it seems, and as much as it just makes common sense as a waste management strategy, compost is this kind of incredible ecological process that we get to speed up. So adding compost to the soil not only increases organic matter, because if you've managed your compost pile well and kept the decomposition aerobic, meaning there's air in the pile, and so air-breathing bacteria are decomposing it, rather than anaerobic, which is that sour, rotting smell, or almost, it can even be like a methane-like smell that very oxygen-deprived compost can get. And the reason to keep it aerobic is just because the decomposition happens much faster and more efficiently. You'll still get good compost if your pile goes anaerobic and stinky. This might take longer and might not be as nice to work with at the end. But what's happening if you've got a well-managed pile is you've not only turned a huge amount of dead organic matter into very dead organic matter with humus, but you've also got in that sponge of newly made compost, you've also got the complete or a large part of the complete soil food web present at a microbial level. You've got bacteria, you've got fungi, you've got microinvertebrates, you've got all kinds of stuff in that pile that then can inoculate your topsoil when you add the compost to your topsoil. What some people also do with their compost, and this is work that Dr. Elaine Ingham of Soil Food Webs, who's now at the Rhode Island Institute, has really worked on, is you can use some of your compost to make what's called a compost tea. You can basically make a concentrated liquid out of your compost, which has all of that concentration of microbial life in it. And then you might have a limited amount of compost, but you can inoculate a much wider area of land with that compost tea. So that's a technique that people use to kind of kickstart soil biological processes in places where the soil has been really damaged.
When you mention about an anaerobic compost pile, one thing that I've been looking into is biogas generation.
Yeah.
Do you know if the resulting sludge from that would still be useful as a compost product for this process?
I don't know, but I do know that if something doesn't have heavy metals in it, meaning if it's just carbon and hydrogen and nitrogen and oxygen, and then the minerals that exist in plants and animals' bodies, if it's just that life building block stuff, even if it's weird post-processing sludge, it can still decompose into organic matter that can be helpful to gardens or farms. So I don't know the exact process that you'd use to work with post-refining sludge from a biogas generator, but I don't see a process by which that would become unuseful.
Just your mention of heavy metals, then one place that would be a concern is if someone was working with a Superfund or a contaminated site, they wouldn't want to compost those materials and try to add them back to their garden without some kind of additional processing to remove those contaminants.
That's correct. And so just to review, unless you're talking about radioactivity, which is a whole nother can of worms that's beyond the scope of what we're talking about here, but in most cases, in most Superfund sites or other contaminated soils, two broad kinds of contaminants that you're looking at. There's hydrocarbon contaminants, meaning long carbon chains that are made, big complex organic molecules that are made from some part of the process of refining petroleum or other fossil fuels. So you've got hydrocarbon contaminants, or you've got heavy metal contaminants. And those heavy metals are atoms of metals that are lower on the periodic table, and they are produced deeper in the Earth's crust, closer to the mantle. And those heavy metals, because they were produced deeper in the Earth's crust, they haven't been part of the matrix of atoms that life has evolved with on the top of the Earth's crust. So from a really big picture point of view, that's why they're toxic, because our long evolutionary history hasn't included those metals in very high concentrations in our environment. So our bodies don't know what to do with them. They can't break down because they're just an atom of cadmium or an atom of lead or an atom of mercury. Because of that, they have to be worked with really differently in remediation than hydrocarbon contamination, like from an oil spill. And of course, it should be said that some hydrocarbons contain heavy metals as well. But hydrocarbons, because they're just long chains of carbon and hydrogen and oxygen, usually carbon and hydrogen with some nitrogen, they can be broken down. Those chains can be broken apart and those can be made into other things. And there's especially lots of species and strains of fungi that are very, very skillful, you could say, at breaking down gnarly organic molecules. But with heavy metals, because they can't be broken down, the only remediation option is to accumulate them and then remove them, if you want to clean them out of a particular piece of land. So there's some fungi that will accumulate heavy metals, and there's also a whole field of what's called phytoremediation, which is the use of plants to accumulate metals. In fact, in China, in some silver mines, they've figured out how to use plants to increase the efficiency of the silver mining, because they get their initial mine tailings, then they grow these silver accumulating plants in those mine tailings, and then they harvest all those plants and put them through a centrifuge and get more silver out of it, which is kind of crazy. But that's an example of how much these hyper-accumulating plants can collect of particular metals.
Well, thank you for that extended answer on that. I didn't want to take us too far afield, but just to cover the basics on these.
Yeah, that's really important.
Thank you, though, for that. So we were talking about compost and mulch and what that does to increase our organic matter and the roles they play.
And just to say a word about mulch, mulch is basically the same process as compost, just a little less intensively managed. Because it's less intensively managed, you don't necessarily be turning a mulch pile in situ on your garden. You're just passively letting it lie in layers. The layering of mulch becomes important so that we can mimic the layers of natural decomposition process. So the most coarse material in mulch would go on top and the finer material would go on the bottom. But again, mulch compresses time in a particular place so that the decomposition of 20 years might get concentrated into 1 year. And there's been, you know, a lot of people in the organic gardening movement have done work on no-till gardening and even no-till farming that's based on prodigal use of mulch to build soil rapidly. And one thing to think about with that is, where are you going to get the organic matter? You know, right now, we've got waste streams of organic matter that we can intercept. We've got bagged leaves in the fall that we can take off the side of the road, or even sometimes get delivered to our house. We've got waste mulch that people will drop off. We can scatter cardboard from dumpsters. But those streams might not always be available as those resources become more valuable, or they might come with a price attached instead of something that we can acquire for free. So mulch strategies, it's worth thinking about where we're getting the mulch. And one thing to think about is the integration of animals into our farms and gardens, because there's naturally occurring waste streams from what we do with animals that we can use as mulch or as a compost component, like spent bedding from rabbits or chickens or goats or whatever. That spent bedding, that packed down straw that's saturated with urine and feces from those animals, super rich in nitrogen and carbon and microbes. And sometimes that might be a direct mulch we can apply, and sometimes we'd compost it to refine it. But just starting to think about, where are those on-site resources that we're already producing that we can use as a mulch source? And the free sources are great, but I think as more and more people use these practices, and I've already seen this happen in parts of New England where those resources used to be really abundant for the early adopters aren't as easy to get anymore.
I've noticed that here as well. There are still some companies that I can get free tree trimmings from and wood chips, but other companies that have gotten these calls more often, now they're going for, you know, what was once $25 for 8 cubic yards in a truckload are now $25 a cubic yard, depending on who you talk to and what their products are.
Right. So I think that's all I want to say about compost and mulch right now. And just that there's a lot of resources out there and a lot of knowledge that's embodied in people who've been doing this for decades. But it works. It works because of basic biological and chemical processes that we can harness. So I think the next one I want to talk about is another two-part one. I want to talk about using plants to build soil. And one part of that involves using cover crops to build soil. And the other part of that involves using perennial plants to build soil that aren't dug up and plowed under. So the process of harvesting crops from the field, whether that's cutting broccoli heads or harvesting corn, or maybe it's cutting down the quinoa plants to then thresh and process the quinoa seeds out of that harvesting process removes from the field and therefore removes from the soil a significant amount of organic matter and nutrients. And what cover cropping does is it grows plants that will not be removed from the site. They'll stay on site in place and they'll be incorporated into the soil directly. So this is one of the simple modifications that's possible to conventional farming systems, which is adding a cover crop period to a cycle instead of continual cropping. And that's really well understood, even in the mainstream agronomy world, about the soil building ability of cover cropping and that can give you a more long-term sustainable farming system. But you can cover crop on a small scale as well. You don't need to have a tractor. You don't need to have many acres. You can cover crop garden beds. So I've grown winter rye on a garden bed that I didn't have plants to put in at that time. So I grew a fall crop of winter rye there and then just let it die back. I didn't even turn it over. And then in the spring, I had all the soil that had been built by the decomposition of those roots in the winter rye bed, and I had a mulch layer from the above ground parts having died back in the fall. So that can be a simple practice for passively improving soil, even when we might be doing compost and mulch and other strategies. So that's just a tool for the toolbox.
When selecting cover crops, like you were using winter rye where you are in the Northeast because you could plant it and it would die back. For someone who's in a warmer climate where that might not die back, for their garden, they might choose a cover crop perhaps that's shorter that they could then shade out with their transplants in the spring or just select other species that would work better for their environment.
Yeah, that's a great practice. And if you can have cover crops that grow through the winter, all the better. There's a lot of flexibility around how those systems get put together. But I really like that idea of, you know, instead of the added labor of having to go out and thresh down or cut down or mow or scythe down the cover crops, just let them die back naturally, either by winter or by the dry season coming or by being shaded out by our larger crops. The second part of building soil with plants that I want to talk about here is using perennial plants to build soil. And that's different than cover crops because they won't die and be reincorporated, although, as we'll see in a minute, some of them will. But the underground root system will stay alive even if that's the case. These are like long-lived soil-building plants in one place. Now, there's two major categories of perennial plants that we can use to build soil. And the first one is nitrogen fixers. So nitrogen, despite being something like 70% of the gases in the air that we breathe in the atmosphere, is a super stable little molecule that's not very accessible to plants in its N2 gas form. But it's critical for plant growth. So plants have to get nitrogen from somewhere. Now, one place that plants can get bioavailable nitrogen is from the breakdown of animals. They're the dead bodies of animals themselves breaking down into organic matter and other things in the soil, or from manure from animals that can be very nitrogen rich because of the decomposition that the animals have done in their guts. Animals can build nitrogen in a way that's available to plants. Plants can also access nitrogen through nitrogen fixation, and that's a symbiosis between bacteria that live in little nodules that certain plants grow for them and those plants themselves. So the plants make sugars in the nodules that the bacteria eat, and the bacteria turn gaseous nitrogen into different forms of nitrogen that plants can use. So it's another one of these kind of trading relationships. And there's a limited set of plants that can do that. There's some really fascinating kind of extremophile plants that fix nitrogen, like certain lichens. The plant component of the lichen-fungi relationship will fix some nitrogen. There's very salt-tolerant grasses that grow in the Great Basin that fix some nitrogen. But mostly what we're talking about is these plants in the legume family, the pea family, the Fabaceae, and a few other families that have these nitrogen-fixing nodules on their roots. So when those nitrogen-fixing plants grow in a particular place, even if nothing else happens, because there's a continual death and regrowth of fine roots in the soil, those plants are adding nitrogen to the soil just by growing there. They're slowly pumping more and more nitrogen into the soil around them by the dieback of their roots, and then they grow more, and then the roots die back, grow more. The nitrogen that they're using to grow comes from the air through those bacteria. Just by planting nitrogen-fixing companion plants, a simple way to do that would be to have a nitrogen-fixing shrub at the end of a hand-dug bed of vegetables so that it's adding some nitrogen into the soil surrounding it. And remember that we think of plants being below ground, a mirror of what they look like above ground. But in fact, in most cases, plants' root systems are much wider than they are deep. And they'll extend wider out beyond what their crown looks like above ground. So their influence below ground is larger than it might appear. So we can companion plant perennial nitrogen fixers even with annual vegetables, but we can also do what you're suggesting, Scott, which is use a herbaceous annual nitrogen fixer like clover as a cover crop as part of our rotation. And that's a double benefit of the general benefit of cover cropping plus the nitrogen fixation. We can also companion plant perennial nitrogen fixers with other perennial plants. So maybe some of you heard Eric Tonsmeyer's interview on this show recently where he encouraged people to build forest gardens and use lots of perennials. So if we're experimenting with perennial polycultures, with combinations, mutually beneficial combinations of perennial crops, including nitrogen fixers in those combinations is going to build soil fertility so that the plants can grow. And having more nitrogen in the soil that's available to plants causes plants to grow more quickly above ground and below ground. And that fixes more carbon in the soil and in those plants' bodies. So the soil fertility through nitrogen is an important component in the carbon farming aspect of building soil.
And with the perennials in this polyculture, as the nitrogen fixers are growing and they're sending out those fine root hairs, they're building nodules with those bacteria in those fine root hairs, even those fine bits that we can't see. And then as those die back, that's leaving that nitrogen in the soil?
That's right. And the larger roots die back as well. Now, one way we can speed that process up is by coppicing our nitrogen-fixing perennials. So coppicing is when we cut something down with the intention for it to regrow from its roots. And most conifers, most needleleaf cone-bearing trees and shrubs will not regrow from being coppiced. There's a few exceptions like redwoods, but most conifers will not regrow, but nearly all broadleaf deciduous or broadleaf evergreen trees and shrubs will. There may be some really unusual nitrogen fixation going on in certain conifers, but for the most part, all of the shrubs and trees that fix nitrogen that we might use in our gardens and farms are broadleaf trees, so they will regrow when cut back. So let's say I've got a black locust tree growing, and black locust is a fast-growing tree in the pea family that grows across North America, and it fixes nitrogen. And it makes wood that's valuable for certain timber products also. So if I'm growing black locust, and then I'm going to cut the black locust pole down to make a fence post, the above ground removal of that tree will stimulate dieback below ground, but it won't stimulate a complete dieback. It'll stimulate some dieback, especially if I cut it during the growing season, and then the stored energy in the roots will cause a new round of growth to begin. So by coppicing, by cutting down the nitrogen fixing above ground parts periodically, it's like pumping more nitrogen into the soil
through the regrowth of those roots below ground.
When you cut that down and the roots die back, as it begins to grow again in next growing season and the new stems appear, is that growing new roots from the roots that were left alive? Like, it's not going to in any way regenerate the pieces that died back. It will actually be generating new root structures?
That's right, yeah. So because roots are kept alive in part by the sugars made from photosynthesis, during the growing season, when above ground green living parts are removed, there's less sugar to feed those roots, so some of them have to die. But as the tree grows new stems that start photosynthesizing again, then new roots can regrow from those.
Continuing this cycle of putting more nitrogen into the ground as the root structure becomes ever more massive.
Exactly. So sometimes people call this chop and drop gardening with their fertility plants, with their nitrogen fixing plants, where, you know, maybe once a year, or maybe for some plants, like I'll talk about, maybe many times a year, cutting them back, mulch. Sometimes you could mulch with those above ground parts if the plant's small, or you could use them as animal fodder and feed them into your fertility cycle in a diversity of ways. So even if I'm just using the black locust pole to make fence posts, I've got all of those branches and leaves and foliage. The value and fertility from those can be captured and stored in my ecosystem also.
And this is another technique then, as you start looking for resources on the land that you're growing so that you're not importing from these other sources that could become rare and more expensive.
Exactly. Yeah. And so then the other category of fertility plants that I want to talk about is what are called nutrient accumulators or dynamic accumulators. These are usually deep tap-rooted plants. Sometimes they're trees and shrubs, but often they're herbaceous perennials. These deep tap-rooted plants that bring mineral nutrients up from lower layers of the soil and accumulate them in their bodies, especially in places where there's a high annual rainfall and there's movement of water through the soil horizons throughout the year. Over time, water-soluble nutrients will move down in the soil. And that can, over time, lead to soils becoming leached or less fertile. So one way to kind of stop or remineralize topsoil is through bringing some of those nutrients back from deep taprooted plants. Another way that I mentioned is by direct remineralization using rock dust or sea salt, which people have been working with in previous years. There's an organization in Massachusetts called Remineralize the Earth that has a lot of resources about that. And traditionally, in coastal areas, the migration of migratory ocean-going fish provided that remineralization in the ecosystem. So the salmon and shad and alewife and sturgeon and lamprey runs in the Northeast, or the salmon and steelhead trout and lampreys and many other migratory fish on the West, those runs went deep up into the mountains to spawn, and then these huge fish died by the thousands every year and got eaten by the whole food web up in the mountains, and their minerals from the ocean that their bodies were full of became part of the soil. So there's been cycles of remineralization that have happened through animals historically, and some of those cycles have been interrupted now. So if we're on a really small place, we can't undam the rivers and bring back the salmon right away. We can, on a small scale, use these deep taprooted plants. And the iconic one that I want to tell people about is comfrey. So a lot of gardeners have a terror of comfrey because it's so difficult to get rid of. Any little chunk of the root will regrow into a new plant. And so some people have made the mistake of trying to till up comfrey to get rid of it. What they end up with is a dense field of comfrey because all of those scattered root chunks have regrown. But comfrey is the monarch sovereign of dynamic accumulators. It accumulates many different valuable mineral nutrients in high quantities, and it's a very vigorously growing plant. So the way to, or one way to use comfrey as a fertility plant to build soil is to let it be where it grows and then several times a year. And if people want to avoid the comfrey spreading, I recommend they do this before it sets seed. So while it's flowering, let it flower so the bees can harvest from it. But then as its flowering is completing, cut it back to the ground with a knife or machete. And then mulch with those really nutrient-rich leaves that you've just cut down. That taproot will pump up nutrients from deep in the subsoil to grow new leaves. And those leaves will mature and flowers will come out. Let it flower again, let the bees get what they need, and then come back and cut it back. And I've gotten 4 or 5 cycles on some good years of this chop and drop with comfrey. And those I've made compost with the comfrey. I've made really nutrient-rich compost teas out of comfrey leaves. And I've also just mulched them around fruit trees or in forest gardens just as they are.
I have several large, vigorous comfrey plants growing on my property that I got from an individual a few years ago. And most of them grew from root cuttings that were no more than about 2 inches long and about as big around as a number 2 pencil. And they're huge. When you say about it spreading, one thing is I believe that there is one variety that's called the Russian Bocking 14 is sterile and will only spread by root division.
Yes, that's right. There are sterile cultivars. And you can also just prevent it from producing seed.
And it also has its carbon to nitrogen ratio is something like 9 to 1. So it's very good for getting a hot compost pile.
Oh, nice. I didn't know that. That's another amazing thing about it.
Yeah, it's just a great plant that I think everyone should include if they've got some space.
Yeah, it's also a good aloe substitute for burns. It's a good first aid plant to have around. The mucilage inside of the stems applied ectopically to an external burn.
Good to know. I could probably do an entire series of shows on comfrey from the things that folks share.
The Comfrey Podcast.
Yes.
There's 2 more broad strategies that I want to talk about here for building soil and sequestering carbon through building soil. The first one that we looked at was using mulch and compost to speed up the natural process of soil building. And the second one that we looked at was using plants to build soil, using nitrogen-fixing plants and accumulator plants. The third one that I want to talk about is using animals to build soil. I alluded to this earlier with how animals can provide plants with bioavailable nitrogen through their manure or just through blood and bones and organs and everything else. But in the way that in a tallgrass prairie in North America, a herd of buffalo that might have numbered in the tens of thousands in one herd might decimate a square mile of prairie as it travels through, just tilled and torn up and grazed down to the root. And then that prairie would regrow vigorously from its 10-foot deep root system, and the manure would just be increasing the topsoil that prairie had access to and fertilizing it, and that disturbance would bring vigorous regrowth, and the buffalo might not be back to that spot for 25 or 30 years because of the vastness of the landscape that they were traveling through. In that same manner, we can mimic that disturbance process with large herd animals on a small scale by using rotational grazing with whatever kind of livestock we're using. We can use rotational grazing to build soil in pastures. I just visited a really cool property in Massachusetts where it was a south-facing hillside and it was all forest. It was all pine and hemlock forest. This was land where the soil was sandy and rocky and poor to begin with, acid sand, like we find throughout a lot of the Northeast. And it had been overgrazed in the 19th century, as much of the land of the Northeast was by sheep. And so there's a lot of topsoil loss from that. And then it had been overcut and high-graded for its timber in the 20th century. So this is like the triple bad news of poor soil, overgrazing, and then overlogging. And this landowner had cut a small field out of the forest. He'd cleared an area of the forest to farm in. And he'd said, well, this soil is really bad, but I know I can improve it with animals. So he went through the very laborious process, which isn't always necessary, but in this case he chose to do it, of removing stumps and large rocks from the field. And then he pastured in a rotational manner. He pastured pigs and chickens on it for 3 years. So the pigs were rotated at different times of the year. Sometimes they went in the woods. Sometimes they were in the pasture. The chickens were moved around with movable fence. The pigs had multiple fixed paddocks that they rotated through. And after those 3 years of grazing from pigs and chickens, he was able to get a beautiful pasture of timothy and bluegrass and other grazing forages going on that soil that had been really acid, sandy, poor soil just a few years before. So it was still sandy, but the fertility had been increased through topsoil building from rotating these animals through and adding their manure and working that manure into the soil through their hooves and just all the disturbances that animals create. So that was a really inspiring look for me, how animals can regenerate land even in a small period of time. And there's a number of caveats about it, though, too, because as anyone knows who's worked with pigs or cows or any of the heavier animals especially, they can do significant damage to soil if they're not managed correctly. So using animals to build soil requires a great deal of planning. Because animals are expensive, it requires financial planning. Because animals are often infrastructure heavy, it can require kind of whole systems planning and design. Even just a few hours of planning, how is this going to work at all times of year? Where in the landscape am I going to do these different functions? So if you do that, then you can, on a small scale, do the kind of work that Holistic Management International does, where they use rotational grazing to restore very overgrazed, desertified ranches in the American West. And just through sending the cattle into a small area for a little while to add manure and create some disturbance, and then letting it rest for a long period of time, they can, over time, rebuild soil and biodiversity in places where the continual grazing pressure of the past has removed them.
I was fortunate enough here in Pennsylvania recently to go on a farm tour where the farmers 5 years ago converted from, if you will, modern agriculture and moved towards mob grazing with their cattle. And they've doubled the size of their dairy and beef herds in the last 5 years. And the farmer who was giving the tour, she talked about now she can go up to some of those fields that they've started mob grazing on and where it was compacted before and just kind of jump on it because there's now this bounce and a spring back to the soil that's been built in just a couple of years.
Yeah, it's a remarkable thing what animals can do ecologically on a pasture. If the rest period is long enough and if the disturbance is enough to add a lot of manure and scratch the soil and stimulate a regrowth from those perennial plants, but not too much that it creates erosion and compaction. It's not just a planning intensive process, it's also a management intensive process because the grazier or farmer has to be watching the field to tell when the right time is to move the animals. It's not as simple as just having them on a calendar schedule. You have to observe with the plant's response, with the weather, with how the animals are using the field, how many animals you have at that time of year. So it creates a very intimate relationship with the landscape, and it can produce some really remarkable results.
And I look forward to seeing what some more of these results are as these processes spread from farm to farm, as what you're seeing in the Northeast, what I was seeing here in Pennsylvania with that farmer. And I'll have to look up some of the information from Holistic Management if they've got pictures of their transformations as well.
So the last strategy that I want to talk about here in the time that we have is about using a fourth method to add carbon to the soil. So in wet, humid, tropical soils, the conventional wisdom is that all of the fertility and nutrients of those soils are held in plants and animals. They're not in the soil itself. And there's chemical and climactic and ecological reasons for that, that have to do with how old and weathered those soils are. They have almost no retention capacity for nutrients, and the climate is so warm and so humid that decomposition happens extremely fast. So nutrients get rapidly uptaken into plants right away. But as European people explored the kind of newly colonized Amazonian rainforest in the 16th and 17th and 18th and 19th centuries, what they would find scattered from place to place was these mysterious, deep, black, rich soils that were incredible for gardening and farming. And in the 20th century, as the kind of sciences of soil science and ecology and geology started to look at the rainforest, there was no explanation for what had created these deep, rich soils. In so many rainforest soils are extremely weathered, extremely nutrient poor, with almost no organic matter and very little fertility. But they were finding these, they called them the terra preta, the dark black soils of the Amazon. So at one point, someone looked at soil from one of these terra preta places under a very powerful microscope. And when they did, what they saw was tiny fragments of charcoal in the soil. And they realized that these soils had to be man-made. They had to be created by charcoaling and fire. So there's a ancient history of building fertile soils through charcoal in South America and in certain other parts of the world.
Fire management has been used ecologically by people around the world in traditional cultures and traditional economies for thousands of years for a lot of different ecological and economic purposes, especially habitat management for game animals and ecosystem management for staple food crops and on and on. But what I want to focus on here in this soil discussion is on the charcoal element of some of those systems, and in particular, understanding why charcoal as a soil amendment does what it does. So the word that you'll hear surrounding this topic, this practice, is called biochar. And sometimes people distinguish between biochar and terra preta. I don't make a strong distinction between those two for the purposes of what we're talking about right now. But what's interesting about charcoal as a soil amendment is that you'd think that it wouldn't do much because it itself contains no nutrients. What's happening when charcoal gets produced is that in a normal fire, the heat of the fire is thermally decomposing the carbon chains that make up the dead plant material that you're burning. And oxygen being added to that breaks those chains apart, and that releases energy and heat. And the gases that are released ignite, and that's the flame that we see. But if you burn plant material in the absence of oxygen, so in a mostly oxygen-free, mostly airtight environment, a very low oxygen fire, what happens is that the plant material still thermally decomposes and releases gases and heat, but it doesn't release, the carbon chains don't break because there's no oxygen to break them. So the carbon chains stay intact and everything else gets off-gassed. And that's what charcoal is. It's just the carbon that was part of the structural building blocks of that plant. So charcoal is almost pure carbon and doesn't have chemical attachment points for mineral nutrients. But what it does is it has a very complex and interesting structure. It has a sponge-like structure on a microscopic level. All those filaments and crevices and niches that a piece of charcoal contains then become the environment in the soil for water to get stored, for that water to carry mineral nutrients with it, and for more humus to form in those crevices and sponge-like structures. So charcoal is, in a sense, two different things as a soil additive. One thing is it's a structural additive. It creates a structural environment in which the soil food web can take up residence and water storage can increase, and through that process, nutrients can get stored. But it also is a direct addition of carbon. and organic matter that will slowly decompose into other forms of organic matter over time, and as an additional benefit, store carbon that used to be in the atmosphere in the soil. That's the nutshell of the science of why charcoal and biochar is a promising technique for soil building. I do want to point out that there's a lot of work and research happening on biochar around the world right now, and there's been some really strong critiques of some of that work too, and I think that's worth mentioning and looking at for a second. One critique of people working on applying biochar on a larger scale is that if the feedstock, now the feedstock is the plant material that's being made into charcoal, if the feedstock is coming from land that would otherwise be producing food, in other words, if crops are being grown just to produce charcoal instead of to produce food, it's potentially a similar scenario to some of the ecological and social problems created by ethanol corn, where food-producing land is bought by agribusiness companies and converted into a fuel crop. So there's a similar potential challenge with large-scale biochar production. Another potential challenge is that the process of making charcoal while it stores carbon also releases a bunch of other pollutants into the atmosphere, some of which are greenhouse gases, some of which are not. And so in the same way that in the complex, changing, relocalizing food economy, there's probably a role for biofuels in some places and some situations, probably a role for charcoal and biochar as well. And I think we could identify that the place where biochar production really makes sense is where it's diverting a waste stream that would otherwise be off-gassing in a landfill rather than going to a productive use. Or in a scenario where biochar production is multi-product, those more complex chemicals that are off-gassed in the charcoaling process can, with the right technology, be recaptured and liquefied from a gas form into a liquid biofuel. So it's possible with the right kind of kiln to have two-product system where you put raw organic matter, you put field wastes or corn husks or switchgrass or, you know, small diameter wood and brush or whatever it is into the kiln, and you get two products out at the end. You get charcoal, which can then be used as biochar in the soil, and you get fuel. So that's the, in some ways, the really interesting promise of biochar is that it can set up these kind of little industrial ecosystems. And then in addition to charcoal and fuel, it's also the waste heat from the charcoal burn is powering a small generator or boiling water to turn a turbine or heating a greenhouse or heating a building. So because there's potential multiple yields from the process of making charcoal, it can, I think, potentially play a role in turning industrial processes into more ecological processes. And I think that's one of the interesting potentials that it has. And on a small scale, biochar also has the potential to create a high-quality soil additive on a small scale and also relearn a fascinating ancient skill of creating charcoal efficiently.
When you're talking about charcoal as biochar, is this final product, even though it's coming from different sources, similar to the charcoal that someone would buy a bag of to cook on their grill with if they were buying like lump charcoal as opposed to, say, briquettes?
Great question. It's different because the material that's used to make charcoal as a biochar, as a soil amendment, is much smaller and finer than the material that's used to make lump charcoal for grills. And the reason for that is that if you put big chunks of charcoal into the soil, they're just going to sit there like rocks. They're not going to incorporate into the soil matrix in a way that small diameter, finer materials will. So that's why a lot of the people making charcoal for soil work are making it from fine, small diameter field wastes like corn cobs, corn husks and switchgrass and other things like that.
So the final product as it comes out of their kiln has already been reduced to a fine material. There's not as much additional processing as say, someone were turning a lump of wood into charcoal. If they wanted to integrate it, they would have to break it down probably mechanically into a smaller product with a larger surface area before putting it into the ground. Someone can't just take their ashes and chunks of leftover charcoal from a grill and just go out and add it to the ground and use it in the same way as biochar. There's a bit more to the process.
Right, exactly. Like if you had a source of charcoal from a wood stove or grill, you could make that into biochar, but you'd probably have to grind it up with some kind of bigger version of a mortar and pestle. You want something that's really fine grain, and the surface area that you mentioned is a really key variable. So the reason that biochar can work as a soil amendment is because it can get incorporated into the O and A horizon of the soil. It can get incorporated into the soil matrix easily, and that happens because of a high surface area to volume ratio. That can happen when it's really fine grain.
And I've seen figures that an ounce of powdered charcoal has something on the order of 500 to 1,500 square meters of surface area.
Wow. That's a lot. I could believe it, though.
And that begins to make sense, then. If you have all that space integrated in such a small amount of material, as you start increasing the quantity in the soil, not by grams, but by kilograms or by tons per acre, how that can trap so many of the nutrients that are coming through.
Right. It's a substrate builder that also stores carbon, because it is carbon. One other caveat I just want to mention is that there's still a lot of research going on about some of the more subtle chemistry that's at work with biochar. And some of that research is around things like what happens to nitrogen in biochar systems, what happens to phosphorus, the macronutrients. What are the chemical interactions going on with this particular form of carbon being added? So we're still learning a lot about how biochar works ideally. And there's people who are scaling up onto a farm scale, and a lot of people who are doing smaller research and experimentation in small gardens and farms. But that's really the stage it's at. Whether it's research through a formal scientific method or whether it's just practitioner research and experimentation, we're definitely in a learning by doing phase of using biochar in our food systems.
Are there any additional resources you would point someone to, books, websites, videos, or anything that someone could look for to find out more information about biochar, since it is still, well, I shouldn't say that it's a young discovery, because it's an ancient discovery that we in the modern society are relearning about. But to match up with our modern views of knowledge, if someone wanted to find out more?
Sure. Well, I would point people towards the organization Biochar Northeast, which is kind of a clearinghouse for information, and they run events, and they have a lot of resources on their website, tons of PDF documents that explain the whole process and look at different angles of the question. So biocharnortheast.org would be the first place I'd point someone to.
Okay. I was also recently pointed to Albert Bates, The Biochar Solution.
Yep. I've heard of that book. I haven't read it. I think the last point about some of the subtler chemistry questions around biochar, and also some of the kind of political questions around who's making biochar, how, for what end, I think they point to something about these four different soil building techniques we've talked about, which is that something like cover crop or compost or building soil through woody perennials, those are techniques that in some ways they're kind of hard to screw up. It's hard to make a big mistake with cover cropping or compost or planting trees to build soil. Because even if there's some design issues of how, or planning issues of how you've implemented those things, you're still building soil through that cover cropping, through those trees and shrubs, through that compost. It's still building your ecosystem. And there's two strategies that have some potential downsides. One of them is biochar that we just talked about, and the other one is the use of animals in rotational grazing. The potential upside of both of those is very high. The potential downside can be also very high, as the history of land degradation through overgrazing shows with animals and as some of these unanswered questions about biochar show. So I would say that animals and biochar, you know, although they're very different, they share a quality of we have to really know what we're doing in order to use them on a larger scale. And especially for biochar, we're still in many ways figuring out what those larger scale applications even look like and how they work. So I would just add one note of caution, and that if you're thinking about soil building strategies for your garden or farm or landscape, to have a realistic assessment of your skill set and experience with these different strategies and choose ones that are more fail-safe if you're still in a learning and training phase of things.
Don't listen to this series that we've put together and then wake up on a Monday morning and decide that you're just going to start rotational grazing without going out and getting the additional education to figure out how to do it properly.
Exactly. But do wake up and decide you're going to start composting and planting a cover crop in your garden, because those things are hard to screw up.
And that's a perfect call to action of something that someone can do. Well, as we move into the winter here in the Northeast, it's a little bit harder, I guess, to do some of that. But as spring dawns and the gardens begin to bloom, that we can begin to build soil with those methods and take the time to gain the knowledge we need to try these other, if you will, more advanced techniques.
Definitely.
That seems like a really great capstone to everything we've talked about. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to this conversation for the listeners?
Well, I think maybe just a note of encouragement that the global crises of our food system are really real, and the solutions to those are really well known and well understood and well practiced. And some of the more experimental work around things like biochar, you know, that's interesting and important, but even if we left that out, we have all the tools that we need. And the problem isn't finding the solution. The problem is figuring out how to replace what's not currently working with the solutions we already have.
Do you see that being a bigger issue from a cultural and societal systemic change issue, or a matter of just getting this knowledge into the right people's hands?
Great question. Yeah. So the problem of figuring out how to turn what's not working into what we already know does work isn't a problem about information or technology or education. In some ways, a more complex problem of incentives and power and leverage points and ultimately belief systems. And that requires maybe different tactics and different ways of thinking and doing things than simply if we educate enough people, then everything will get better. It's more complicated than that. What I want to encourage people in is that the ways to move towards a more regenerative food system start with very simple practices on a very small scale, but there's very few obstacles for many people to implementing. And if people don't even have a garden, that can be things like building relationships with people who do grow food and being involved in their agricultural cycles of the year. And people who have small-scale gardens, there's so many opportunities to build soil and save seeds and participate in your local food culture through the act of small-scale gardening. And then for people who are working on a larger landscape, the opportunities to move things in an eco-socially good direction are endless. So I just want to encourage people, there's an abundance of opportunity to build soil and regenerate our land and create a healthier food system, and that people are doing it all around the world.
And I'm sure for anyone who's listening to this, if they look in their local community because of how much these movements are pushing forward, that they'll be able to find someone in their own community who's doing this that they can connect with and build relationships with and learn more from.
Absolutely.
Well, Connor, I thank you so much for the time that you spent with me, the work that we've done to overcome some of the technical hurdles that I mentioned here, but the listeners will never notice as we put this entire series together. It's been a great time, and I look forward to talking to you again in the future about more of your projects. And also definitely keep us in touch the next time you guys are doing the carbon farming course, if you're going to offer that again as a full series that I can both get that information out there and hopefully be able to attend.
Sounds great, Scott. Thanks so much for having me on the show for these two episodes, and I really enjoyed getting to connect with you and learn about your work, and I'll definitely keep you in the loop about carbon farming projects in the future.
That's great. Thank you very much, Connor. Take care.
Take care, Scott. Thanks.
And that wraps the second interview with Connor on carbon farming. If you'd like to find out more, I've included links in the show notes to Biochar Northeast for all your biochar needs. I also have a link to the Wikipedia entry for Terra Preta and biochar, because there's a lot of information on there, and get a nice overview about how to produce and use biochar and the references at the end of that article. I know we shouldn't be referencing Wikipedia for a scholarly article, but the references that were used to write that article are really helpful for getting a broad understanding of just what biochar is and is not capable of, and some of the research that's been done with it so far. My next episode is going to continue the conversation about nutrient-dense foods as I interview Dan Kittredge of the Bionutrient Food Association, and we talk about that organization's mission and work to educate both farmers and consumers about how to grow and find the most nutritious foods possible for ourselves, our family, and our community. If you have any questions about this episode or any other material, feel free to contact me, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or call the voicemail line, 717-827-6266. I'd love to hear from you. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.